Hi, I'm Ben Trefney, news director here at KALW, and I want to invite you to become a member of KALW. We are 70% listener supported, so as you listen to this, please make sure to go to the Donate Now button at KALW.org. Thanks.
KALW.
I will test any other human being that's older than me. They deserve a test before someone like me deserves a test.
As the Bay Area shuts down to prevent the spread of COVID-19, who's being left behind?
We have directed to no longer permit large non-essential events in this state.
An update on the novel coronavirus. Then we explore the overlooked Black history of San Francisco's waterfront.
So these are ships that go back to the 19th century. What we found is that a third of the sailors were Black.
And we'll answer a question about the Bay Area from a listener like you.
How did there get to be an entirely separate city inside Oakland?
Why is that? Find out coming up next. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. We're starting today's show with an update on how the coronavirus is affecting the Bay Area. Here's KALW's news director, Ben Trefney.
Disneyland is shutting down. The NCAA men's and women's basketball tournaments have been canceled. The San Francisco Unified School District will close to students for 3 weeks beginning on Monday. And the state of California says events with 250 or more people should be put off to slow the spread of the COVID-19 or novel coronavirus. Governor Newsom stood with health and business officials Thursday morning to talk about executive orders he's making because of the outbreak. For one thing, he's removing the waiting period for unemployment and disability insurance for Californians who lose work because of the pandemic. Newsom said his team is running scenarios on public safety and public health, as well as economic conditions. Then Newsom referred to the state budget, which is currently being discussed.
And the wonderful thing about standing here in March and not in June and July, or worse, August, is that we have a revise coming up that was going to happen on the natural, and now will happen with all of this benefit of new information, and we'll meet the moment.
For California's homeless population, advocates are concerned the coronavirus will eventually spread quickly. Louis Chiquin is president of Abode Services, which works with thousands of low-income unhoused people throughout the Bay Area. He says right now there hasn't been a widespread outbreak in the community because homeless people are isolated. They aren't as susceptible to risk factors like exposure to large groups or travel. But
it seems pretty clear that age is a vulnerability threshold, 16 above. And we know that from other data that if you're homeless on the streets, for example, and in your 50s, you're basically a senior in terms of your health. So you could likely move the vulnerability from 60 to 50 for homeless people, and that's a large portion of the homeless population now.
Plus, he says, there's a risk factor of poor hygiene.
Because of sanitary conditions, particularly for those who are on the streets, they don't have the luxury of, even have access to soap and sanitizer and other methods of that people are using to mitigate contraction of the virus. So I think once it reaches the homeless population, it's going to spread pretty quickly, is what we're afraid of.
We'll continue covering this rapidly changing situation on KALW's airwaves, website, and social media channels. For KALW News, I'm Ben Trefney.
Thank you, Ben. Ben Trefney is KALW's news director. Stay tuned to KALW to stay informed on what you need to know about COVID-19. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. John William Templeton is widely known as the authority on San Francisco Black history. His passion is unearthing and preserving the stories of African Americans who helped shape our city and state. He wants to defy stereotypes, but he also is passionate about giving young Black residents in particular a sense of pride and belonging here. Templeton's been leading walking tours and bus tours. Now he's launched a Bay Tour to share some of that often hidden history from the water. KLW education reporter Lee Romney tagged along to get a preview.
Hey! How you doing?
Doing pretty good. Here's your ticket.
I meet John on a gorgeous windy Saturday in front of the Red and White Fleet's vintage ticket booth at Fisherman's Wharf. He's a young-looking 65, a tall man with a big, contagious laugh.
Who's coming today?
I have no idea.
John's been testing out this tour since last summer. He was a journalist when he fell into the role of historian, activist, and publisher about 3 decades ago, after he'd learned that many of the early founders of Los Angeles had African roots.
So one of the things we point out is where Alex Haley lived. He wrote Roots here, and he got on a freighter here and sailed it across the Pacific so he could simulate what it was like. Langston Hughes, when he came here in 33, took a ship from China.
This helps answer one big question. Why do an African-American history tour from the water? Well, before commercial air travel took off, most long-distance travelers came in and out of San Francisco by ship. And we're talking way before Langston Hughes, the literary icon known as the leader of the Harlem Renaissance.
Hello, good morning. Tickets for the last line, please.
There you go. Welcome aboard.
Hey, there she is.
I made it. Hi, how are you?
Deborah Watkins, the educator's educator.
Deborah is the founder and executive director of the California Alliance of African American Educators. She's come up from San Jose to check out the tour so she can recommend it to other educators and possibly bring up some of the young people she works with.
Bobby has a little line.
John has spent decades poring over early census records, troves of Black newspapers, and documents from fraternal organizations. He curates the California African American Freedom Trail, a collection of 6,000 historical sites, 400 of them right here in San Francisco. We launch, and his facts tumble out, many of them surprising even to someone as schooled as Deborah Watkins.
So these are ships that go back to the 19th century. One of the major things that happened in the late 19th century was the salmon trade to Alaska. What we found is that a third of the sailors were Black.
We pass the USS Pampanito, the World War II submarine docked at Maritime National Park.
So that's the exact kind of submarine my father served on. And he was the messman.
Stationed not far from here, out of Mare Island.
The only Blacks that could serve on the submarines were the cooks. So my father is 18 years old when the first Blacks go in the Navy, and the only person who got to take a shower every day was the cook.
Wow.
He's the only Black person on the ship. He's the only one taking a shower every day.
Wow, story.
So it's kind of ironic.
About a mile to the west, John points out the Maritime Museum. Inside are the frescoes of Sergeant Johnson, another Harlem Renaissance leader.
Came here in 1915 for the Panama Pacific International Exposition. By 1922, he won the San Francisco Art Association first prize.
So, another hidden figure!
Yeah.
It's the 19th century ship captains with African roots that seem to delight John the most, though. People like William Alexander Leidesdorf, who was born in the Virgin Islands.
He had a white father and a Black mother.
He passed for white, even became a cotton broker in New Orleans before he turned to the sea.
In 1841, he set up the first shipping warehouse, built the first shipyard. He built the first hotel in San Francisco, the first general store.
And the first school. Then there's Michael Healy, who was born into slavery in Georgia.
Commander of the revenue cutter was essentially the military governor of Alaska. So he was Black.
Deborah can't get enough of it.
So Captain William Shorey.
How do you spell his last name?
S-H-O-R-E-Y.
R-E-Y, okay.
So Shorey commanded the last whaling ship on the Pacific. So he was a good friend of Booker T. Washington. And so a lot of the support for the historically black colleges and universities came out of the black affluent class in San Francisco.
John tells us about the black money sent east to finance the Underground Railroad, too, and the passage of the 15th Amendment, which guaranteed black men the right to vote.
That's part of the narrative that gets lost when we just think that black folks came here in World War II to work on the shipyard, because the black community here was in the middle of everything.
Even on Alcatraz.
Cell Block C was segregated, so a third of the prisoners at Alcatraz were always black. So we got all these letters that were writing to Eisenhower and Bobby Kennedy trying to end segregation. So it was a major, major thing.
We talk about Maya Angelou, who studied drama and dance during World War II at the Communist California Labor School, a college for adults.
I know about her. It's the labor school.
So, yeah.
And Otis Redding?
On a houseboat in Sausalito when he was...
That's where he wrote City on the Dock of the Bay.
Yeah.
But John, who also publishes curriculum for schools, tells Deborah his greatest hope is to shift the mindset of the younger black generation.
We grew up in a time where we were kind of sheltered by a supportive black community.
Yes.
So we didn't, I mean, these kids have no defenses against, you know, Fox News and all that sort of thing. So they don't think they belong at all. And so these are the kinds of interventions that you have to do to just kind of shock them back into the belonging that they should have. You can't tell the lie of black inferiority.
Right.
After you've been on this tour.
That's right. That's right. I'm stuck on Captain Healy.
I know.
I'm just one guy. I mean, I'm just stuck on Captain Healy.
John is now close to wrapping up an audio version of the tour with production help from some talented San Francisco black teens. Once that's done, any tourist who boards a Red and White Fleet boat for a Standard Bay cruise will have the option of listening to his tour on their headset instead.
Artificial intelligence, I guess I'm replacing myself.
In San Francisco, I'm Lee Romney for Cross Currents.
The story is part of Lee's ongoing series, Learning While Black, the fight for equity in San Francisco schools. You can reach her at education@klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Next up is Hey Area, our crowdsourced journalism project where we answer questions from listeners like you. This one came from New Yorker staff writer Jelani Cobb.
How did there get to be an entirely separate city inside Oakland?
KLW's Imran Ali Malik went to find out.
Ever since I looked for my first apartment in Oakland, I've had the same question. Why is Piedmont its own city? It's this small 1.7 square mile municipal island in the middle of Oakland. The border is based on an old sewer line, so you can't see it. But sometimes you can feel it, like Leon does in the Rose Garden.
This is kind of split in two sides. To the right of us is the Piedmont side. The left side is the Oakland side.
Leon Sykes is a 35-year-old black man, local radio host, and self-described Oakland town representer. He grew up and still lives by the Rose Garden. But in 3 decades, living on the Oakland-Piedmont border, he's gone to Piedmont only a handful of times.
Kind of always been felt like we weren't necessarily wanted. Even like growing up in like kicking in the Rose Garden is that little miscreants. I knew that there's one side, like on the Piedmont side, don't be over there after 10 o'clock. But on the Oakland side, like, they're not really going to trip as much.
Piedmont is mostly just large homes, a gas station, a few banks, a market, and City Hall.
Beautiful Andalusian fountain right outside of City Hall.
That's where I meet Assistant City Administrator John Tullock.
So Piedmont was founded in the late 1800s as a resort community for people in San Francisco to come take weekend trips to.
But when the 1906 earthquake happened, thousands of newly unhoused San Franciscans flooded into Oakland, and the city began rapidly expanding. That's when a group of Piedmonters who were nervous that their city would be swallowed up by Oakland organized a vote for Piedmont to become its own city. The vote passed by a very narrow margin.
Piedmont has been a city, its own city, ever since.
Oakland grew and now surrounds the city of Piedmont. And today, Oakland is one of the most diverse cities in the country. The population of whites and blacks are almost equal. But in Piedmont, out of 11,000 residents, less than 200 are black.
A lot of times when people ask the question, how did Piedmont get to be its own city inside of Oakland? What they really mean is, how did Piedmont stay so white?
Eli Moore is a researcher at UC Berkeley's Haas Institute. He and his colleagues recently published a paper on the Bay Area's history of housing discrimination. He says that places like Piedmont are the result of strategies to keep neighborhoods white and hold on to wealth. In the early part of the century, this was done through violence and intimidation. Sidney Deering, his wife, and children were the first black family to buy a home in Piedmont. Not only were they not welcomed, but 500 people gathered outside of their home to protest. And their home was firebombed 3 times.
The police refused to provide protection for them.
The chief of police was also a local leader of the Ku Klux Klan. The city government offered to buy Deering's home. Sidney refused, but then the city tried to condemn the house, claiming that they need to build a road through it. I don't know what happened to Sidney Deering, his wife, or children after they were forced out of Piedmont. But I went to 67 Wildwood Avenue, the house that Sidney Deering once bought for his family, and it's still there. Looking at an old picture from a newspaper, it seems like it hasn't changed at all on the outside. Perhaps it's the legacy of this dark time that accounts for Leon's feeling unwanted in Piedmont. But he recognizes that Piedmonters today, on the whole, are more sensitive about matters of race.
I did read about the mayor that was ousted for some very ignorant thoughts and racist thoughts that he had posted maybe about 2 years ago. So there is showing some growth, and there is showing that diversity is starting to become important, and I would just love to see even more of that.
Maybe the story of Piedmont is also the story of America, our struggle to make our principles a reality, and the healing we have yet to do for the wrongs of the past. In Piedmont, I'm Imran Ali Malik for Cross Currents.
Imran is a fellow in KALW's Audio Academy. And now we're going to take you to an urban escape. It's the next episode of the Golden Gate Park cast. We're taking you through the park from east to west, celebrating its 150th anniversary. San Francisco is a city of art. It's in the murals of the Mission District, the halls of the city's many museums, and sometimes in some unexpected places. That's what Laura Clivens experienced on a bike ride she took. Here's how it happened in an excerpt from our new Golden Gate Park cast.
Sunday mornings are sacred, but not for any religious reason. It's when I head out for a weekly bike ride through Golden Gate Park west to Ocean Beach. But one weekend, I decide to go on a Saturday instead. I take my usual route, cruising through the aromatic eucalyptus trees along the Panhandle, hugging the curves of John F. Kennedy Drive in Golden Gate Park. And when I arrive at the White Conservatory of Flowers, something's different. On my left, a soothing and out-of-place sound emerges. It's jazz.
We used to call this the Conservatory of Flowers, and we used to call this the Conservatory of Music.
That's Aaron Cohen. I find him with three other musicians playing underground. He's got his hands on a shiny alto saxophone on the southern end of a tunnel, about 50 feet long, that runs under JFK Drive. The musicians are perched on one side of the tunnel.
Some of the stuff I practice, my neighbors wouldn't want to listen to. So you can work out your stuff here. I use it as a rehearsal space.
But you wouldn't guess that. It sounds like a straight-up performance. Paul Corella plays a tenor sax, and he says there's a backstory to this musical gathering.
I remember coming through the park, this is over 10 years ago, and hearing somebody playing guitar. And I came out, and that's where I met Sid, who was a fellow who lives near the park, who would use this as his practice room down here. So I brought my horn down, and we played, and then I just started coming down and practicing here if I had some time, because I didn't live too far, and we'd get together on the weekend and play.
When it's not raining or freezing, any number of jazz musicians can be found here on Saturday mornings, improvising melodies and wooing passersby. The musicians say the demand for their music in formal venues has gone down, making the tunnel sessions more significant over the years. Sitting on the steps, I watch as the musicians sway to the music, making eye contact with each other, nodding their heads in time, revealing subtle smiles. They are clearly enjoying themselves, and it draws people in. Couples approach and share a kiss. Young children come and dance. At some point, a family of Spaniards approaches. The father picks up a free guitar and sings a spirited version of Guantanamera that Cohen is happy to accompany on his sax. Corella says this space is key to the magic that they're creating.
The acoustic properties are really something. I mean, I play different spaces, and this has just got a wonderful hang time. It's not too long, just long enough to make the sound. It's very round.
It's very musical.
Yeah, and it's very, it's got a, just sounds good.
That guy who jumped in to agree is Peter Tittelbach. He's an electric guitar player, originally from the Czech Republic.
It's better than Carnegie Hall or whatever, you know. Or Davis, Symphony Davis Hall. It's got better acoustic than Symphony.
It's fun to hang with these guys. They seem like old friends. They say this is where they're free to play around and improvise.
I'd say it is, sure. You know, and if it works for them, you know, then, you know, they'd become, I'm sure, a part of it.
By works for them, he means they need to withstand a democracy, a musical one, that is.
So far, it's like no leader. People just come on their own. You know, nobody tell what we're going to do. You know, and it's some people cannot take it. Like, there was a guitar player, and he said, I cannot play with band which has no leader. And I said, this is most democratic things I can find, you know, because, like, nobody ever, you know, kind of, like, want to be on top.
I can't imagine who wouldn't love this. But Corella says there are a few downsides, like the chilly wind.
You know, brass instruments really get cold, and they go flat, so you gotta, you know, you have to make up for it by tuning your instrument to to an extreme that makes it sometimes very difficult to play.
And then there's mention of some mosquitoes here and there, and the rare instance of a park ranger visit.
We had a nice crowd here, and we're playing great, and a park ranger came, and he was really feeling guilty about it, but he told us that he said, oh, well, I'm just telling you, I got a complaint that you have to go. But you don't have to go. You know, he said he was going to call in sick next week so he wouldn't have to do this.
Good call. As it nears 1 o'clock, the wind picks up and the musicians begin to pack up. Their stint here is over this week, but they'll be back next week and the week after. And it's not for any recognition or any tips, actually. Paul Carella says, since it's not a hired gig...
If we blow a few notes here and there, it's okay. It's more about, I think it's more about our just getting some experience.
And for people like me, passing by, it's about an experience too. The one of stumbling across something surprising on a familiar path.
That story was produced by Laura Clivens. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.